Welcome to the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. We've got Joe with us today, and we are back here. It is September, Joe. The kids are back into school. We have a new season of the Baseball America College Podcast, and I guess you guys heard some new sounds before you start hearing my familiar voice. And Joe, can you explain our new intro music?
Yeah, it's pretty cool deal. I reached out to a musician friend of mine, and he was able to put that together for us, kind of a little jazzed up version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. But his name, and I kid you not, is Bruce Bonebreak. That is his birth name. I did not believe him. He provided the documentation to prove that was the case. But yeah, really talented musician, plays all kinds of instruments. And so if you happen to live in the St. Louis area, he's in about a million bands. But ranging from, you know, harder stuff close to metal to pop punk. He was in a country band for a while. But so if you're in the St. Louis area, he and his bands play all around their various venues in St. Louis and over on the Illinois side of the river. So check him out if you have an opportunity. But yeah, really thankful for him doing that for us, because I think it's kind of a cool
version
of it. So,
Joe, can you put Bruce Bonebreak, outstanding name, and then number one on the Baseball America College Baseball names list this last season was Itchy Burtz, number two, Zacharias Raspberry, number three, Zebulon Vermilion, number four, Bear Bellamy. Does Bruce Bonebreak break into that foursome were he a college baseball player?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's definitely in that top four or five. I don't think he usurps Itchy Burtz, just because that's just there's a lot of things going in Itchy Burtz's name that I think puts him in the top spot. It's first of all, having the first name Itchy, or that being the name he goes by, is great. Also, it's short. I feel like there's something funnier sometimes about the short, succinct names. That's one of the reasons I really like Cross Factor from Oklahoma State, just because it's short, it's succinct. The only thing that would make Itchy Burtz better is if his name was Itchy Burns, because those would be two sensations you can feel on your skin, you know, itching and burning. That would make it a little bit better. I think that's the only thing that could be improved upon with his name. But yeah, I think Bruce's name probably cracks that top five. I don't know that I like it more than Raspberry, but maybe more than Zeb Vermilion. I know that's lofty praise, but I think it's a great name, especially for what he does. Like, he's a musician, Bruce Bonebreak. That's just a guy who just plays guitar in a rock band, for sure.
Yeah, that is absolutely outstanding, and we appreciate it. It's a fun way to kick this podcast off before it goes completely off the rails. And so we're back now. We took the summer off. The last time Joe and I recorded, it was July. The season had just been wrapping up. We kind of wrapped up some stuff from Omaha and left it a little bit open about when we would be back. Well, the answer is the start of September. A lot has happened since then. We're not going to attempt to cover all of it. It's just not possible. A lot of it, though, if you're curious, still has been covered over at baseballamerica.com. So make sure to check anything out there that you may have missed. But we have had a couple of significant things in the last week here as September has begun, and the college, new year has really come about. And we want to get into those. One of those is our top 50 college draft prospects ranking. That has been updated here at the start of September to reflect the changes from the summer, the developments, the improvements the kids went through while they were playing summer ball. And then also we had our top 25 recruiting class rankings come out last week as well. So we'll get into those in a second. First, though, I wanted to talk about Head of the Class, which is a new book that we are putting out here at Baseball America this year. It's a book about the last 40 years of college baseball, looking back at the great players, the great teams over the last four decades. And I think that, if you're listening to this podcast, you're a college baseball fan, and I think that you will probably find, I think it'll be a lot of fun to take that trip down memory lane through these last four decades. We're talking about, some of the great teams like that LSU had in the 90s under Skip Bertman, the rise of a program like Wichita State under Gene Stephenson, and of course so many great teams from Fullerton and Miami and that great 03 Rice team, and then more recently, you know, of course the Vanderbilts, the Floridas, you know, that everything like that is going to be compressed into this book. We're going to have a lot of historical stuff. We're going to have some newer stuff in terms of kind of contextualizing the decades, looking back at each one of these years. So if you are interested in that book, you can pre-order online at baseballamerica.com, at store.baseballamerica.com specifically. And of course, pre-ordering is very helpful. If you're interested, check that out over at store.baseballamerica.com. Now, Joe, let's get back to some of these rankings here that I mentioned. And let's start with the top 50 college draft prospects. The list is again, as it was at the start of the summer, led by Spencer Torkelson. But we've had some shakeups, and you know, if you look at the high school list, and Carlos had a podcast about that, so you guys may have listened about that. You know, there were some guys at the top on that high school list that took some significant falls. That didn't really happen on the college side. What we had instead was some guys making some significant jumps. I'm talking about Nick Gonzalez, New Mexico State second baseman, Cape Cod MVP, number one prospect on Cape Cod, Carmen Mladzinski, South Carolina ace, who missed pretty much the whole spring with a broken foot and then established himself as the best pitcher on the Cape. You know, those are two guys that really jumped up. And when you look at Nick Gonzalez, what he did this summer, Joe, I mean, just how impressive was that? I mean, that's a guy that was an All-American. He had a fantastic spring. He led the country in hitting. But I don't know, for me personally, there was some, yeah, but it's altitude. Yeah, but it's New Mexico State. I understood he was good. I think when he did what he did on the Cape, that really made me understand exactly how good he was.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, what you say there is kind of echoes my feelings on it. And as someone like myself who has an affinity for the smaller conferences, the smaller programs, I was heartened to see what Nick Gonzalez did this summer. There's a proof of concept there that this is not just a guy who plays at altitude. This is not just a guy who has feasted on whack pitching. This is a guy who, you know, has a chance to be a big leaguer, has a chance to be a big league contributor. And I think he needed that kind of summer to kind of prove that he was always going to get a shot. I mean, what he's done was enough to get him a shot. But I think now it's put him in a different stratosphere in terms of being taken, you know, seriously as a prospect. So, you know, you compare that to some other guys, and I don't want to necessarily blow up anybody's spot, but there have been other guys who have come along who put up big numbers in places where you expect to have big numbers put up, whether that's on the West Coast or whether that's in a league like the OVC where numbers just are eye-popping year after year. You know, Nick Gonzalez this summer was able to kind of take himself out of that category and put himself in a totally different category. Now he's kind of a transcendent prospect, not only for the New Mexico State program, but also in the WAC. I mean, he's going to be a guy who is going to bring a lot of heat out to a lot of places where there hasn't always been a lot of scouting heat. So that's kind of big, not only for him, but also, you know, that's also a good opportunity for his teammates and other players that play in his conference. So, you know, I enjoyed seeing him high up on that list for those reasons. You mentioned Carmen Mladzinski, and he's a guy who there were a lot of reasons why, you know, South Carolina's season in 2019 didn't go the way they had hoped it would. But a big one was Mladzinski going down so early, because you could kind of, I think I even mentioned this early on in the season, that you could kind of squint pretty hard. And, you know, if Carmen Mladzinski's a true Friday guy, and, you know, some of their offensive players took a step forward, you could kind of squint hard enough and see how South Carolina might be able to at least keep themselves in a regional discussion. And when Mladzinski goes down, though, that kind of slides everybody down. And by the end of the season, it was at a point where they were really kind of patching things together on the pitching staff and trying to, you know, string good innings together. And so, again, him being healthy and being a part of that rotation, I don't know that it fundamentally changes the result of South Carolina's season. It certainly makes them better. I don't know if it puts them in a regional, but certainly that was just kind of a big blow for them early on. They were never able to recover from. So I think if you're a South Carolina fan, I think you have to look at it as, you know, him being healthy and showing what he showed this summer, I think is goes a long way.
I think the other thing I wanted to note from that list is that, you know, it started well for Arizona State at the beginning of the summer. Torkelson was number one, and Alika Williams was on there at 21. It's only gotten better, though. Alika Williams is now up to 17. I absolutely love watching him play. He had a really good summer with Team USA. I think he's pretty clearly the best defensive shortstop in the nation. And, Nick Lofton looked really good, kind of as his understudy. But Alika, looks very much the part there. They're at shortstop. Not that that's news to anyone at Arizona State, but, good confirmation that he continued to do it against the competition the national team was facing this summer. But then Gage Workman is now on here after a nice summer playing shortstop on the Cape. He's going to go back to the hot corner for the Sun Devils, but he's really starting to put things together as well. And then RJ Dabovich came on very strong on the Cape. I think that what happened this summer was kind of what Arizona State was hoping would happen this spring. He was just a sophomore when he transferred in from junior college. Sometimes it takes those guys a little bit of time, and he was banged up as well a little bit this spring. So it seems like he's started to really get strained out. And if he can be that guy, they need someone in that rotation because, of course, Alec Marsh went in the draft, and that leaves a hole on Friday nights, and so Boyd Vanderkooy could need some help in that rotation wherever it's going to come from, and Dabovich certainly looks like he's capable of providing that, or maybe even being the lead guy. We'll see how that all shakes out, but so I think that Arizona State had a really nice summer. This is something that a year that I think we had thought Arizona State was building to, and now it's really starting to get here. So I was impressed with their overall summer. Just from what you see looking at Arizona State right now, it does seem like this is the pieces are all starting to come together for them to take another step.
Yeah, for sure. It's one of the teams I'm most excited to see in 2020, just because I think they've got the opportunity to do something that hasn't been done in Tempe in a while and get back to Omaha. And, Jason Kelly's a big part of that, too. Obviously, that's separate from the talk of the prospects and the players. But, he's coming on as pitching coach, and he's widely considered to be one of the best pitching minds, not just on the West Coast, but in the entire country. And so you take some of these raw materials, and the talent on the pitching staff hasn't really necessarily been the question. It's just kind of finding roles and getting guys to live up to their potential, and the depth could be improved for sure, but there's talent there. And RJ Dabovich is a guy you mentioned right off the bat is kind of the lead of that. And so if Jason Kelly can kind of come in and have an impact on just the existing pieces they have, I think it could go a long way towards shoring up the pitching, which was really kind of the issue for them last year. Let's be honest, they could mash, and they're still going to mash come 2020. So yeah, I'm really excited to see them. It's kind of a similar story for Miami for me. That's one of the other teams I look at. They've got guys littered on this list too. Freddy Zamora, speaking of defensive shortstops, Freddy Zamora's on the list, a couple pitchers in Chris McMahon and Slade Ciccone. That's a team that kind of feels like they're on a similar trajectory. I think at this point, I think I probably like Arizona State's high-end talent and potential there, but I think they're kind of on a similar pace in terms of historical power that hit on a little bit of hard times there, missed regionals a couple seasons, but now kind of seem like they're back on the right track. And maybe 2020 is a little bit of a breakthrough season, because I really like Miami's talent. They've been collecting impressive talent for several years now, and we're just kind of waiting for it all come together. Last year, it felt like it was a near miss on what could have been a really good team. There were some injury issues in the pitching staff late in the year that kind of led to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting they're going about it a little bit differently. Arizona State very much on the slug inside, and Miami is doing it a little more on the pitching side. When you look at the wealth of arms they have going into next year, it's very solid, and potentially the best in the ACC without fully breaking it down. I mean, I would guess that Louisville has something to say about that with Detmers and Miller at the 1-2, but what Miami can do on the mound has a chance to be pretty special. And maybe this is just because I have this little bit of the historical bent right now, because I've been looking at this head of the class stuff. But don't know, is it weird to you, Joe, that Miami has these like two all-time great coaches that everyone can immediately associate with the program in Frazier and Morris, and then ASU doesn't really have that? I mean, Pat Murphy was there for a long time, maybe because he didn't win at the end, like that maybe that makes him a little bit different, but like what do you make of this thing that I'm sprinting on you right now?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring. I hadn't really ever considered it, to be honest with you. But if you would have told me, so if we'd have played this game before, if you'd have said, you know, hey Joe, what are the coaches you associate with Miami baseball? You know, you would have come up Ron Frazier and Jim Morris, bang bang. If you'd have said Arizona State, I would have given you pretty quickly Pat Murphy. But it would have taken me a second to come up with Brock. But then you've got the kind of this period of transitional years with Tim Esme, where they were still getting to regionals, you know, but they moved on from him. And you've got Tracy Smith that has some fits and starts at the beginning of his tenure, but seems on track now. And I think some of it's just circumstantial, you know, where, you know, they parted ways with Pat Murphy. And I think you're right that, you know, there were some teams, I think, towards the end of Murphy's tenure that I think maybe there were some expectations on that this was going to be a national title winner for Arizona State that fell short of those expectations. I mean, the talent they had on display from, I don't know, like 05 to 10 or to 11 was just incredible, absolutely incredible. Some of the most talented teams I've seen in person. And they just were never quite able to get over that hump. So I think maybe some of that's coloring it. But then also the way he left, I mean, it was kind of a contentious end to Pat Murphy's tenure in Tempe, and so perhaps that has something to do with it too, whereas I think at Miami, there's not really those types of conflicted feelings about Frazier and Morris, and I think maybe had the end of Morris's tenure gone a little bit differently, and by that I mean, of course, his last couple of years, they missed regionals, but, you know, the couple of years before that, they got to Omaha in back-to-back years, so I think there was still a little bit of feel-good from that for him to live off of there, so maybe it's that there's not really complicated feelings about those Miami coaches, whereas with Arizona State, there are some complicated feelings with Murph in particular. And then, you know, what do you do with Esme, who was an assistant for Murph, and then he got to regionals, but those teams weren't as talented. I think there's maybe just some kind of like muddying of the waters with the legacies of those coaches. And perhaps that's why we are where we are with them. Cause I'm with you. I mean,
those two programs, and you can throw George into this as well, as, you know, big time powers that had fallen on some lean times and are now going to enter 2019 with big expectations. Georgia with the biggest of the group, I would think. But, you know, all three are going to be looking to make some pretty significant noise come next June. But we will have plenty of time to discuss that over the next several months. Did want to touch on the recruiting rankings, where Vanderbilt, again, number one. Sixth time Vanderbilt has had the number one recruiting class in the country. That is a record. This class is headlined by Jack Leiter. That is Al Leiter's son. You might remember him from pitching in the big leagues. Jack Leiter is pretty advanced himself. He should be able to come in and have an impact right away. And, you know, everyone saw what Kumar Rocker did. And so there's going to be a lot of expectation that Leiter does that. That's pretty lofty. But at the same time, you know, he is expected to, you know, be an instant impact freshman that, you know, even if he doesn't step into the rotation, one of the things we talked about with Rocker, how rare it was that a Vanderbilt pitcher step into the rotation like that, you know, from opening weekend on, really, how rare that was in Nashville. So we'll see if Leiter can do that. But if he can't, they'll find a use for him, no doubt. And I'm sure he'll pitch important innings for Vanderbilt. But it's a deep class overall. They have they have nine players from the BA 500, you know, which of course includes all draft eligible players from last year. So nine of those kids are now at Vanderbilt as freshmen, and you know they're going to make an impact. You know, we'll see which ones make the instant impact, you know, that we've seen from some Vanderbilt freshmen in the past. But there's no doubt this is a highly talented class. Number two was Ole Miss, and Ole Miss is a really fun class, I think, because it's very athletic, in part because there are two football players in it. Jerian Ealy and John Rhys Plumlee are both playing for the Rebels this fall. Ealy is, in addition to being one of the top, you know, baseball freshmen in the country, he could be one of the top football freshmen on a talent basis. The first two games haven't been super impressive for him. He's a running back, but he was one of the highest rated running backs in the country in the class of 2019. He has said a lot, though, that he kind of prefers playing baseball. So we'll see where that all goes for Ole Miss. He's very, I don't want to say raw on the baseball field. He can do a lot of things, but there is certainly some rawness to the game. He's going to have to figure out some hitability things. And, you know, what does that mean for him this spring, especially when he hasn't had a fall ball? What does that look like? No one really knows, but he'll certainly be given a chance to go out and help the Rebs on the diamond. And then Plumlee is a quarterback who is rated better as a quarterback than as a baseball player, but is still a very well-regarded baseball player. So that gives the Ole Miss class a little wild cardness to it. But they have, I mean, you look at, you know, infielder Connor Walsh and catcher Hayden Dunhurst, and they have some premium impact players even away from the Ealys and the Plumlees. So that's an exciting group. Florida with another top five class led by left-hander Hunter Barco, who was the second highest ranked player behind Leiter to make it to campus. Again, that's another high impact arm for Florida. We know what Kevin O'Sullivan can do with high impact arms, so I'm excited about that. Number four, TCU. Number five, UCLA. Kind of got there in two different ways. TCU has a bigger group, has some JC guys in there. They're really trying to recover after the draft hit a couple classes in a row for them, so they're trying to inject some talent right away there. I think there's talent all over the field for the Frogs on this group, but the arms are really exciting, and they kind of need those, especially with Nick Lodolo and Brandon Williamson moving on to pro ball. TCU has some holes on the pitching staff, and I think that this group coming in, Kirk Sarlous can do some good work with them, and we'll see where they go from there. And then that UCLA class, it's a small group. It's only nine players in it, but they all have some pretty significant upsides. A lot of them have a really good athleticism, some projection, and the group looks pretty good now, but I feel like 3 years from now it might look amazing as these kids continue to develop and grow in John Savage's program. I think that the Bruins have some really good players there. Michael Curiel is the highest ranked player. Jared Karros is the son of Eric Karros of UCLA and Dodger great. Jared is a pitcher, unlike his father, and he's ultra projectable. He's like 6'6", but he knows how to pitch already, which kind of fits the John Savage mold very well. Very excited to see where he goes. And then I really like Emmanuel Dean. He's a really toolsy outfielder, and so many people I talk to really like catcher Darius Perry. He's got some big tools as well. So some exciting pieces to build around there. I would encourage you to check out the rest of the top 25 online. I broke down every class in the top 25 in somewhat excruciating detail. So BA subscribers can find out all about these new classes, especially your favorite teams. You can really dig into those. Joe, just from what you looked at there, what kind of jumped out from the recruiting top 25 to you?
Well, first of all, what jumped out was the work that you put into those capsules. I mean, because it really is pretty exhaustive. And so those were a great tool for me. You know, you're a little more in tune with these players and have followed them a little more closely. So it was kind of nice for me, especially some players I knew their names. Some are very famous and I know them. Some I knew their names and weren't sure what their profile was. And there were some names, of course, that I didn't know. So I found it really helpful just for me. But it's I can imagine those were pretty work intensive. So kudos to you, sir. Because I'm me, part of what interested me was I looked at the list and scrolled to the bottom to kind of see like who, because it's interesting to me. I mean, you look at the top 10, 15, and you've got a lot of usual suspects there, right? But it's interesting to me who kind of cracks into that top 25. And I understand, and I know from how difficult you mentioned this process was, that there is some hair splitting going on. I imagine it's tougher at the back end to kind of split those hairs. So with that in mind, but it is kind of interesting to see who kind of cracks these things, because I think it can kind of give you a little bit of a window into who's maybe on the rise, you know, who to maybe look out for, not maybe necessarily in 2020 if it's a program truly on the rise, but maybe in 21 or 22. And there were a couple of things. I think one, I think BYU will jump out at
people,
the casual observers, but I think
make sure that BYU is number 25. It's the first time the Cougars have ever had a top 25 recruiting class in the 20 years we've done this. And yes, that that was noted.
But I will say that I'm not, you know, I guess I'm in a position where I follow this more closely, but it doesn't surprise me a ton just because, like, they've got talent. They've been a talented program under Littlewood. Mike Littlewood's doing a really nice job there. They've had a couple tough breaks with, you know, they maybe with a one or two breaks in a couple different seasons have maybe twice as many regional appearances as they have under Littlewood, or three times, or, you know, whatever it is, a couple more, I guess, is my point. You know, last year they were, you know, if their schedule had broken in such a way where they had a couple more top 50 wins, they very well might get in last year. I mean, that team was good enough. And so I'm not surprised from that standpoint. What is interesting about their recruiting classes, though, is that because of the Mormon mission situation, like, these are kids that we still might see in college baseball in like 2025. So that's kind of incredible when you consider 4 years plus 2 years on a mission. You know, these are kids that names we may be seeing for a long, long time. And that also leads to some uncertainty. Like, you don't know, on one hand, a top 25 recruiting class, you know, you might look at it and say, okay, well, BYU could be in a position to be a power, you know, in their world, and maybe run off a string of regionals here. But so those are all things that BYU has to deal with that other programs in this position don't
have to deal with.
That's always something interesting, you know, interesting to watch.
So much changes with that. You hear guys say, like, oh, I'll go to school for a year and then I'll go on a mission. And then that plan changes. And, you know, I feel like this group, from what I could tell, I think the top end guys aren't on that track. But, you know, again, these are very personal decisions, so, and massive decisions to be made. So you can't know for sure, but I think that this is a group that will have impact over the next 3 years, primarily. And I think that, especially when you look at the three pitchers that they got at the top of the class that were all drafted, I mean, those are guys that BYU needs, because, you know, as we've talked about on the podcast in the spring, you know, they played at an altitude that the rest of the West Coast Conference doesn't. And the WCC is a very pitching heavy league. Those guys out there, every school it feels like has studs in the rotation. And BYU, you know, they need to find a way to compete with that. And I think that in guys like Cy Nielsen and Cutter Clawson and Tyson Heaney, they have some guys that are going to stack up really, really well on the weekends over the next few years.
Yeah, there were just a couple of other rapid fire thoughts too. I mean, it was you see Arizona on this list, and I think, you know, they made some late strides in recruiting, and they've been active in transfers, and clearly it's you know, Jay Johnson and his staff are kind of trying to get the that ship headed back in the right direction. Obviously, things have not gone the last couple of years as they would have wanted, so it kind of feels like maybe this is a catalyst for getting that going. Maryland is another name that stands out there. That's a program that really needed kind of an injection of, for lack of a better way of putting it, juice. Certainly under John Sheff, they kind of had that thing rolling, and they looked like a program that was really kind of poised. They've got some things working against it. Their facility is not where a lot of the rest of the Big Ten is. So they've got some geography works against them from a Big Ten perspective, because they are so far away from most of the rest of the league. But they really did look like a program as recently as 2017 that you thought this could be the, if things break right, if they really kind of get this thing rolling, like they could be, you know, the class of the Big Ten and really be a program that kind of leads the Big Ten. I mean, they back-to-back. Now, one of them was when they were in the ACC, but back-to-back super regional appearances at a time when now I think we kind of take that stuff for granted because the Big Ten is where they are, and we just saw what Michigan did and what Minnesota did the year before. But that was at a time when that was a really big deal for the Big Ten. You know, we kind of had Indiana doing that, and you know, Illinois had gotten there in 2015, but that was kind of a few and far between situation. So, you know, Maryland perhaps getting things going back in the right direction with Rob Vaughn. And then I guess one of my last thoughts is on seeing Alabama's name here again. And they've been recruiting really well, as you noted, in the capsule under Brad Bohannon. And I guess the open question that I have about Alabama is, how long is the tail on this thing? Because does that mean, you know, if you're an Alabama fan or alum, does that mean you should kind of prep for regionals in 2020? Is the tail a little bit longer than that? Because the other thing you have to think about is, yeah, they're, you know, whatever they're ranked in the rankings here, but that gives them the – let's see, I'm pulling it up now. So they are – Alabama is number 15, so top 15 class, but I think if my math is correct here, they're number 8 in the SEC. So there's like a sliding scale here where it's like great class, objectively a great class, a lot of talent. In a vacuum, that puts you in a position to be in regionals in 2020 perhaps, and certainly 21 and 22, what have you. But if you're competing against teams that are stacking up talent faster than you, like, how hard is that to catch up? I mean, that just seems like that would be so frustrating. I mean, that's life in the SEC. This is nothing new for Brad Bohannon or anybody in the SEC, but that's what really makes it tough to figure out, like I said, how long is the tail on this where you get that
for
that
sure. Benefit and from this gets talked about a lot. We all believe that Brad Bohannon is going to get Alabama going. But the problem is, to go up, someone has to come down. So who is coming down? And I guess that kind of is the one of the questions here is, you know, how long can that cycle last and all the rest of that. But, you know, I think when you look at this specific Alabama class, there's a lot of upside, but there's also some risk here. And so I think that if Bo is right on these guys and they develop them right, it's going to end up being better than the number 15 class. You look at Connor Prelip and Antoine Jean, two left-handers with a ton of projection, but also they weren't super, like, neither one of them was ranked in the BA 500, which is by no means or without flaw or any of the rest of that. That's not what I'm saying. But, you know, Jean came on very late, very late bloomer. And so it's going to be big for him to continue to develop. He's from Montreal. There are all sorts of reasons why he's a late bloomer. But they gotta keep getting him right. And then you look at Prelip, he's from Wisconsin, and he has great stuff, like really big time stuff. And I think there's a lot of reason to be excited about him. But there's also, like, he's now gonna have to go pitch under the lights in the SEC. And you know, where he's coming from to that is, you know, it's going to be a big jump. And how do you adjust to that mentally? And some of these questions are just unknowns. And then you look at, you know, the biggest name in this class is Miles Austin, shortstop from Atlanta, who has some Will Holland to him. But, you know, Will Holland was pretty raw as a freshman at Auburn, and Austin's more advanced than Holland was. But you know, there's still a little bit of, like, is this like truly an impact freshman, or is this a guy that's going to play and be okay, but like probably realistically be your like sixth, seventh, eighth best hitter. Like, so there's some development to be done in this group. So I think that if I was looking at it just from on September 10, trying to forecast where Alabama is, what this class means for Alabama, I would say a 2020 regional would be ahead of schedule. Now, Brad Bohannon's been ahead of schedule before at Auburn with Butch Thompson. They got ahead of schedule. So maybe this group can get ahead of schedule at Alabama as well. But I would say 2020 is a be much more competitive in the SEC, get out of the cellar in the SEC West somehow, get to Hoover, but probably not get to a regional. And then 2021, get to a regional. I think that's the progression here for the Tide. But again, if a couple of these kids pop earlier than expected, or if they just show up and are ready to do it, on the big stage, then, that window advances. So that's definitely going to be an interesting thing to watch. And, the whole SEC West, of course, is continually reloading. You got Mississippi State in the top 10. You got Auburn in the top 10. Ole Miss, LSU. So, I mean, they're all there, and they all have a lot of talent. So it's a big time ask, and they knew that going in. But it's going to be fun to watch. It's going to be fun to watch all of these SEC West classes that we're talking about here in the top 15. I mean, I think they're all pretty exciting, and they've got some big time talent headed to that division yet again.
Yeah, one of the other things I noted too is we talked earlier in the podcast about how Arizona State and Miami had been kind of compiling talent, kind of building for some point in the future, which now seems to have arrived. And there's a couple teams in there that you mentioned in TCU's overview, for example, they've been really decimated by the draft, and you've kind of seen that in the result on the field, where last year they got into a regional, but they were realistically the last team in, and you could make a real argument they shouldn't have been in. We probably made that argument on the podcast right after the field was announced. So they clearly had taken a step back, and then UVA is kind of in a similar boat. And you maybe wonder if these classes are a sign of maybe those two programs are kind of the next in line for this reboot that ends up cresting at, whether it's 2020 or 21 or 22, but you wonder if maybe seeing them in that position, especially TCU with a top five class, you wonder if maybe those programs are kind of the next in line to kind of go through a similar
that's the
version
hope,
of what we're
certainly.
Seeing with ASU.
Now I keep ranking TCU classes pretty well. So the group that's getting ready to be juniors that has taken some attrition hits, I was ranked pretty decently, I feel like, even though it was hammered pretty good coming out of the draft. I thought there was some big time talent in that. But I think that first of all, clearly I got that wrong. Second of all, though, I think just the depth of this group is going to be what kind of helps propel TCU back. And then Virginia's an interesting thing because they aren't going to go JC heavy. Typically, there are two JC kids in this class and a transfer from the University of Chicago who didn't count to the rankings, but sounds super interesting. So there is some more experience in this Virginia class than maybe they typically have. Usually they're almost exclusively freshmen. So I think that can help in some immediate terms. And then, Chris Newell is, kind of a, I don't want to say big risk, big reward guy, but like there's a high ceiling. He just has some work to do to get there. If he pops, that's a big time impact outfielder for this group. And I'm going to be very interested as well, just to see what these arms Virginia has added over the last 2 years. If you go back to last year when they got Mike Vassell, who pulled out of the draft, had been a potential first rounder, pulls his name out entirely and goes to Virginia, and then some of the arms they added this year. Well, Carl Kuhn now is the head coach at Radford. So who's going to be Virginia's pitching coach? And then B, how does that impact the development of Virginia pitching over the next few years is going to be very interesting to see. And of course, Brian O'Connor has a lot to do with the pitching there. That's his background as well. So they're going to be in good hands, I have no doubt at all. But that is a bit of an unknown right now. But I think that whoever it is going to get some great building blocks, some great pieces of clay to mold. And I think that, I do like what Virginia, can be building towards. And I mean, they were bubbly much of the season here. So it's not like they had an awful season. They showed some improvement from where they were in 18. And, you know, now in 20, I think that the expectation, I mean, the expectation of Virginia is, of course, to make a regional, but in 20, they have to be back in a regional. I think that they have the pieces to go out and do that. And I think that this class is a part of that.
My last thought here is that for some reason, you know, when we have like Eric Karros's kid, for example, in one of these classes, and that doesn't seem to really affect me on the whole, like, holy cow, Eric Karros is old enough to have a kid who's, for some reason, the big names don't really affect me in that way. But for some reason, when I saw that Danny Ardoise's kid is enrolling at Texas, for some, I don't know why, like the more rank and file big leaguers affect me more and just make me feel old. Like, I don't know why that is, but it is. Seeing Eric Karros's name, nothing. Danny Ardoise's name, suddenly I've got one foot in the grave, and I can't explain.
I got nothing for you on that. I'll be honest, I don't remember Silas's father as a big leaguer. I do remember Eric Karros as a big leaguer, but Danny Ardoise is not a high one on my memory list. But that Texas group is an interesting class as well. You know, they got some talent there, and they're going to need that talent to play. And I think that they have some guys that can. You know, Trey Faltin is one of the most versatile players in the country. They could literally do almost anything with him except ask him to catch, probably. They're going to try him out at shortstop first. He's never been just a shortstop. I think that's the plan for the fall, is to just have him play shortstop, see if he can win the job. And then if he doesn't, they'll see what else he can do. But he can get on the mound and pitch if they want. You know, he could run around the outfield if that was where they wanted him, or anywhere on the infield. But the options are almost limitless with him, but it makes for a very exciting package. And then they have some guys transferring in junior college wise that can make an impact. And some of their freshmen last year was a very vaunted class as well. They were a little more ceiling than instant impact. And then I think this year's class is a little more on the instant impact. They have ceiling, but this class is a little more ready to go right now. And then, which is great, but also some of those ceiling kids from a year ago really made some important strides this summer. And so I think that the combination of those two classes, I think the sophomores are ready to take a step forward. And I think this group of freshmen are in a lot of ways pretty ready to go. So I do feel like the Horns are going to make a jump back. You can throw them into that Virginia TCU bit of you know, kind of blue bloods that are looking to roll the rock back up after you know, kind of falling on it. Speaking of fall ball, it has begun, and typically the places where it's begun this early are more northern programs, but. You know, over the next month, really, we're going to see schools all across the country kicking off their fall balls. Joe, you worked on a piece for this month's magazine issue about Eric Wedge getting ready to go at Wichita. That's one of the more interesting coaching changes from the summer, was Wichita State firing Todd Butler and bringing back maybe its greatest alum in Eric Wedge to be a first-time head coach after being a big league manager, and a pretty successful one. He was manager of the year when he was with the Indians in 2007. Now he's coming to the college game. So Joe, just from working on that, what did you take away from your reporting?
Yeah, he's certainly one of the more famous. I think it probably comes down to him or Joe Carter. I guess if you're a more modern, you know, baseball fan, you might know Eric Wedge for his managing days, but people of a certain age, I suppose, maybe would go Joe Carter. But yeah, he's certainly in that discussion. What I came away with there was that he believes in Wichita State's ability to be a national power again. to be at the level it once was. And if so, he wouldn't be there. That's kind of my takeaway there. Because Eric Wedge doesn't need this, right? I mean, he's managed in the big leagues. He interviewed for managerial jobs as recently as a couple off seasons ago. You know, he was working with the Blue Jays. He, from the discussion I had with him, he really enjoyed what he was doing with the Blue Jays. So it's not as if he was on the hunt for whatever's necessarily next. And he said, this was the job for me. He mentioned his introductory press conference. I'm paraphrasing, but he wasn't looking for a college job. It was Wichita State and that was it. And so he really kind of believes in the program getting back to where it was. And so the open question of the piece, and I won't spoil too much of it, but I mean, the open question is like, is that possible in today's college baseball? He believes that to a certain degree that it is. Now, I think he would probably say that, you know, it's going to be tough to get back to the heights that it once was because the game is just different now. But I certainly don't think it's a crazy thought. I mean, they do have things going for it. The history helps for sure. The support is there. There's, you know, a certain subset of people that with Wichita State not having football and the basketball program has obviously been on a really good run under Greg Marshall of late. But the history of Wichita State baseball is really rich, not just in terms of the players and the wins and the championships, but also just in terms of local support. The facility is good, being upgraded, they're working on it. And I think the conference affiliation, I mean, they were in the Valley and now they're in the American. And I think in some years, maybe in 2018, this was the case where had they been in the Valley, they maybe make a regional because they would have maybe been able to win more games in conference and wouldn't have had just the conference record that was unpalatable from a at-large standpoint. But overall, I think if you're talking about becoming the type of program that can not only get to regionals but get out of regionals and put yourself in a position to get to Omaha, being in the American, I think, is a net positive there because you're always going to have baked in quality games throughout the year, which is a big deal when you're in Kansas because you're obviously your midweek games are not going to necessarily be of a certain quality that you can get in the Southeast or on the West Coast, for example. So I think that is a net positive there. Now, obviously, there are challenges there. More competition nationally. I mean, Wichita State came along at a time when they became a national power because Gene Stephenson kind of just spoke it into being. I mean, I think it's really kind of an undertold story about just how little he had to work with in the beginning at Wichita State. And really started winning before he had all the raw materials you think he would have had to have.
I think
really
it's impressive. I mean, so, Eric Wedge in the story talks about being from Fort Wayne, and then he goes to Wichita. You know, like, there's a lot more going on in the Midwest now than there was back then.
For sure, exactly. Yeah, I mean, maybe Eric Wedge in 2019 as a kid goes to Indiana, or Purdue, for that matter. You know, you just – so there's a lot more competition in the Midwest, for sure, and – you know, even nationally, I think there's just been a kind of a power consolidation, in some places where, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, there were major conference programs that weren't all that committed to baseball. Now that's not really the case. Everybody who's playing in the big leagues, to use that term colloquially, is committed to baseball and wants to win and is putting resources behind it to varying degrees, of course. So, and the weather's never going to change. The accent, unless Wichita, Kansas becomes beachfront property and the country splits in half, they're probably not ever going to have access to the high-end talent that you have on the coast. That's just a fact of life. And those advantages they have in the 80s and 90s, they were one of the programs that played 75, 80 games a season. That you can't do that anymore. That was an advantage. You could sell that to kids. If you want to play a whole bunch of games and really play all year, that's what we're doing here. We're going to play anybody, anywhere, anytime. And the scheduling limit being what it is and, you know, restrictions on how many days of school kids can miss, which are positive. I'm not suggesting those are bad. It's just different. And so some of those advantages they had in the days when Gene Stephenson was building a program just don't exist in the same way they do they don't exist like they did then. So I'm interested to see how it goes. I'm certainly there is an energy there. There is a palpable energy. Season ticket sales are up. Eric Wedge talked about just seeing people out around town. And I think coaches will often talk about that and people greeting them in restaurants and out around town. But you can see how it would be different in a place like Wichita with his history with that program. So now it's just going to be a matter of channeling that energy and turning the Shockers into a winner. And it is not going to be easy. But certainly, like I said,
Wichita definitely rose higher than Nebraska ever did. They have the national title. Nebraska doesn't. But those are two programs from generally the same part of the country that haven't been at those heights for more than a decade now, but whose fans desperately want those days back. Like Husker fans really care, and Wichita State fans really care. So like they both have that going for them. Which one do you think has the better chance of kind of, they both have new coaches this year. Will Bolt's coming in at Nebraska, Eric Wedge going back to his alma mater. I guess Will Bolt's going back to his alma mater as well. Which one do you think kind of gets back to that level, or at least breaks through to a super regional first?
That's a really good question. I guess Nebraska would be my answer. I feel like they're starting from a, first of all, to kind of game the question, because I know this is not the spirit of the question you're asking, but they're starting from a better place, right? I mean, they're starting on first or second base as opposed to standing at home plate. So, but again, I know that's not really the spirit of the question you're asking. But I also think that the Big Ten is what it is, such that I think Nebraska is able to, there's no limitations on what you can do from the Big Ten to the extent there were before, but I think perception is important. And perception matters. And so I think there's no more limitation on what they can do from that league. I think Nebraska's brand is really pervasive. I can speak to it living in the Midwest, and living in a part of the Midwest that's not that close to Nebraska. I mean, it takes me, you know, 5.5-6 hours to get to Omaha every year. So I'm not that close, but I see Nebraska people all over the place. It's just a really pervasive brand in the Midwest. I think there's always going to be a pull to a school like Nebraska that Wichita State, just because of not having football, it's not as big a school, as big a brand. I think they're always going to have some of those natural advantages. It is also the big school in that state. If you're a kid growing up in Nebraska, that's probably where you wanted to go to play your sports, no matter what sport it was. Basketball may be a little different there, but especially, you know, particularly football and baseball, you probably wanted to play them at Nebraska. And in Kansas, Wichita State's the big baseball brand there, but KU and Kansas State's are just bigger brands in general. So I'm probably going to go Nebraska. But gosh, that's an interesting question, because I think there are some advantages to Wichita State as well. One of them being just conference affiliation, being such that they're going to get, I think there's less variability in the quality of the games they're going to get year to year. Whereas in the Big Ten, I think there are going to be some years in the Big Ten that are a little leaner. Whereas with the American, I think last year was one of their leaner years, and it was still a really quality conference. I think there's a little bit more to bet on there. So Wichita State's not without its things going forward.
I would also I'll go with the Huskers. If the standard that I just plucked out of the air is just to break through to a super, like, yeah, I think Nebraska's clearly the advantage there. But if we made it a little bigger, like the fact that Wichita's administration has to be as dedicated to baseball as they are, because that's what the fans want, and there's no football. That's a big advantage too, because you know, Nebraska is also trying to return to football glory days, and I'm sure that takes a lot more of their time and resources and effort, and that the fan base wants that one a little more. And you know, so they've got to be pouring a lot into what Scott Frost is doing. I'm sure Will Bold is getting plenty of support, but you know, I would guess that Wedge can get you know, maybe a greater share of the Wichita State pie of attention, money, whatever, just because there is no big football thing there's no big football project to be worked on as well. So I don't know, that's going to be interesting to monitor those two programs going forward. And you know, there were more than 30 coaching changes around the country this year. A lot of really interesting ones from Oregon State and Oregon, USC, Florida State, Wichita, Nebraska, Bryant on a mid-major level. And there's still one coaching job still open, Western Illinois. We'll see when they fill that. Ryan Brownlee moved to the ABCA, where he replaced Jeremy Sheets, who got back into coaching, I believe at the NAIA level in Georgia. So the carousel is actually not shut down yet, even as we are nearing the middle of September. But we'll continue to monitor that as we go. Now we all know how much Joe loves pop culture. I also enjoy pop culture, but Joe wanted us to touch on a couple of the summer pop culture stuff that we missed. And so, Joe, you we've got this this behemoth Old Town Road, which you called being a behemoth very early on, I must add. You guys can go back to listen to some episode in March, April, I don't know. Whenever it first dropped, the second time, Joe was on top of that. And then we have Lizzo, who came on late in the summer. And where do you stand on that debate, Joe?
Well, yeah, it's really impressive, Old Town Road's longevity, because I actually remember that was the first week of April, not because I have some sort of like, you know, a beautiful mind type memory for things like that. But I remember because the weekend after we recorded that podcast, or what have, maybe it was after that. But anyway, it was the first week in April, because that weekend I was at a series at Illinois. Maryland was playing at Illinois. And I just remember that series being the first weekend in April. And they played that song in between innings, and it had hit the internet like 48 hours earlier. So they got a quick turnaround on it, and they played it, and the crowd at Illinois Field applauded. They applauded the sound guy playing a song, which I don't think I've ever, except for fight songs, obviously, I don't think I've ever, for just a generic pop song or what have you, I don't know that I've ever seen an audience or crowd applaud what was being played. So that's kind of how I knew that this was a little bit different. So, but Lizzo has come on strong. I heard about Lizzo, friends of mine. I went down to Texas a couple months now, to see some friends, and they were really into Lizzo, a little bit ahead of the curve. Lizzo's from Houston. She has Houston roots anyway. She went to the University of Houston, studied flute, actually. She was like a classical music major. So actually really talented musician. So I have to applaud Old Town Road for longevity. I think that's where I go. I mean, that's still, I think, the song of the summer, and was the song of really the late spring, frankly. But Lizzo has come on strong and has been kind of just a powerhouse in terms of, you know, I think even casual music fans who maybe wouldn't listen to hip hop as a genre have caught on to her and kind of enjoy her music. So certainly it has been a tour de force performance for her late in the summer. But I just don't think there's any dethroning Old Town Road in terms of,
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it took what, Taylor Swift to dethrone that. So like that's kind of where that's at. So, you know, I think you summed that one up beautifully. Eventually I'm sure that we'll get another Old Town Road remix as well. And he can't possibly be done yet. So hopefully, we've gone kind of caught up on college baseball here over the last couple months. We will, going forward, trying to be back on a regular weekly schedule. Hopefully, Joe and I will also be able to add some guests to the mix as we go through the fall, hear about some of the goings-ons around the country as programs really get back into it and start playing some of these games. We do, of course, have the fall exhibition slate, two games for each team that don't count to the 56-game max, and those will be starting up here in the next couple weeks. I just saw that Michigan and Vanderbilt made it official, and they'll be playing this fall. So that's a fun matchup. I think that people might remember the last time those two teams played. And then, the other, big highlight so far that I've seen is Florida and Georgia playing the night before the world's largest outdoor cocktail party in Jacksonville. And that, of course, being the Florida-Georgia football game. I don't actually know what they're calling it now, because they're not calling it that. But that's that rivalry's name. I don't care what they're trying to pass off that rivalry as. But those two teams going to go at it, which is, just great. I think there'll be great crowds in Jacksonville on that Friday night with all the the fans of those two schools already in town to see the football game the next day. So we'll have plenty to discuss over the next few months here of the fall. So remember to subscribe to the Baseball America College podcast on your favorite podcasting app. We're available pretty much wherever you look. You can also find us on the newly launched Baseball America app, which is available for both iPhone and Android. So you can check that out in the iTunes store, whatever they call that now. I don't have an iPhone or Google Play. Make sure to download that, and you can get your podcasts. You can find them there as well. And while you're there, make sure to subscribe, rate, review if you can. It helps other people to find us and to enjoy the podcast as well. So yeah, make sure to do all of that if you can. If you can't, just remember to go to baseballamerica.com and all of the content will be there for you. And again, I mentioned this at the top of the show, Head of the Class, Baseball America's new college book this fall, examining the last 40 years of college baseball history. If you've made it this far in a college baseball podcast, I really think you're going to enjoy that book and just looking back at the last 40 years, the great players, the great teams, all of the great stories that go into the last 40 years of college baseball. And you can pre-order that at baseballamerica.com. So until next week, thank you for listening. I've been Teddy Cahill, and thanks to Joe for joining me.